So it is 1 o'clock, and we will call this meeting to order of the Port of Port Townsend, Wednesday, July 8th, 2020 at 1 p.m. And we will forego the Pledge of Allegiance and move to the approval of agenda. And we do have agenda before us. Is there a motion to pass the agenda?
I move we accept the agenda as presented.
I would like to request something on the agenda.
Okay.
I would like to request on consent, agenda item C, Navy right of entry, to be removed and placed on regular business.
Okay. That's fine. What's your thinking, Pam?
It's been controversial in the past, so I just wanted to be able to discuss.
Okay. Any other comments, Bill?
No, it's all right with me. I'm taking my same position on that as I have in the past, but it's good to discuss it.
Okay, so let's.
So I make an amendment to my motion to accept the agenda as it is revised with item C in the consent agenda moved into item E of the regular business.
All right. And then Les, does that change? Are we approving a resolution with the Navy thing? I gotta
look. No.
It's not a resolution because it would have been on consent agenda, but it would require a motion then.
Right. Okay. Yep. That's fine. All right, so I'm good with that, too. We got to vote on it. So all those in favor, or we need a second.
Okay.
Anybody seconding? Okay, Pam is seconding. So we have a motion and a second on the table to accept the consent agenda with the modification of moving C, Navy right of entry, to a new point E in regular business. Is everybody approve? Everybody good with that? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay.
Actually, that was the acceptance of the agenda itself.
Oh, yeah. That was the acceptance of the agenda.
Yes.
Do I need to restate that?
No, it's fine.
Oh, yeah. Probably need to, after we have the public comments, we probably need to accept the consent agenda.
Right, with the amendment.
Yeah, that would be a good idea.
Yep. All right, so moving on to public comments. Are there public comments?
I'm not aware of any public comments that I've received ahead of time. Karen, do you have any?
No, I have none.
And we've got four listeners on the call as attendees. I don't see anybody raising a hand at this point to signal an interest in making a comment.
Right. And then moving on to the consent agenda, everybody's had a chance to read and take in the consent agenda.
I've got a request for you on the EDA grant authority resolution that when you approve the consent agenda, it include updated dollar amounts in that resolution specifically to address construction phase anticipated contingencies to increase the grant request to up to $11.4 million and the match requirement then up to $2.85 million. So looking for a motion to approve items A, B, and D with that modification to the proposed resolution.
Okay. I move that we accept the consent agenda items A, B, and D amended with the updates.
And I'll second that. And then all those in favor of the consent agenda, accepting the consent agenda.
Aye.
Aye.
All right, moving on to second reading, nothing. First reading, nothing. We're at point seven, regular business. Point A, COVID update, page 16. Dr. Packard.
13.
Thank you, Commission. So this is our monthly time to consider how COVID's impacting the port and to look in more detail at the model that was developed originally back in April, updated in May, and this is again, stated for June, or for May actuals here in June. This is the first time I think we're proposing changes to the assumptions that underlie the model. And specifically, if you kind of refresh your recollection on page 18, we've got the April 22nd, 2020 assumptions that resulted in a reduction in revenue of just over $1 million based upon what we saw in March, April, and May actuals and kind of how we're seeing the pandemic developing and affecting the port's business model. We're proposing updated assumptions that are dated July 2nd on page 19. Probably the major changes that you're seeing there is we're adding in some of our tourist-oriented income more quickly than we had originally forecast. In terms of our leased properties, we had built into the model a 25% reduction across the board based upon the ability of our tenants to take a deferral. We are seeing our leasehold tenants paying their rents. The deferrals have been fairly small in number. And I think as a result of increased rent from last year and some new tenancies, we're actually seeing our leasehold revenue come in higher than the 2020 budget. So this model deletes any reductions in that area. Likewise, in our permanent moorage, we've really decreased the reduction there because what we're seeing is that our tenants are continuing to pay their bills. And we believe as a result in part of assigning more slips that were available for guest monthly moorage to permanent moorage, those numbers are coming in stronger, and that's in part why we see a reduction in our guest monthly moorage. We still anticipate assigning somewhere around 10 or 12 more slips yet this summer, having done that same number earlier this year. So we think that's going to continue to be strong. The notable changes that are probably worth touching on are on page 20. And if you look right at the top of the list, item number one is the most significant shift in the model. It represents a little over a $400,000 change in ending unreserved cash. And this is a correction from the prior model where the model included spending this money for capital projects out of unreserved cash and also spent the same money out of reserved cash. So the result was we paid for it twice in the model. And this correction, and you'll see lines in there, essentially transferring money from our reserves into the model, which is all unreserved, to make that make sense. Item two addresses the IDD spending. We'll probably maintain this as a separate item on this list as we continue to go forward, just for clarity about how the IDD money is coming in and how it's being spent. You will probably remember that at the end of the last model, the IDD budget was anticipated to have ending cash of about $500,000, and then you spent about $400,000 of it at your last meeting on Point Hudson jetty projects. So it should say 100. In fact, it says 265,000. And that's because of item three, which is really a shift in the way we're imagining utilizing our maintenance crew to do capital works here at Boat Haven. Our original vision was to use more crew time to do a wider area of dock rehabilitation, but less completely. So whalers on all of D dock, for example, was part of the scope. What we're now imagining doing is a smaller section of D dock where we would actually remove the entire floats, take them to the workyard, rebuild them in more detail, and put them back in the water with new piling. So more depth to our work, but less breadth, which results in less cost, because we're trying to keep these projects within a scope that could happen in approximately a month, imagining that if we can do this and it works well, we would do this every year starting now for the foreseeable future, just to ensure that our floating facilities are fully maintained, rebuilt, reconstructed, and ready to roll. So the result in the model is that we're spending less money on maintenance staff costs out of capital therefore more costs coming from the 2020 operating budget. And of course, we have a little bit more money left at the end of the year in the IDD reserve, which is actually not a bad thing. It's very helpful in our imagination to have some of those dollars there to handle IDD projects as they come up. Item 4 is totally new. It's new to the commission as of today. We have been a little bit remiss, I think it would be fair to say, in our fire suppression system testing on our floating facilities. And we got back on board with that program this year and discovered that we have about $65,000 in costs to ensure that those systems are operational. Almost $50,000 of it is at Point Hudson, and about $15,000 is here at Boat Haven. So this model assumes that we're going to do that. In fact, we have started that work. We'll start that work this week. $15,500 of it is in the model scheduled to come out of the Boat Haven Reserve, and $49,125 for the Point Hudson repairs is just out of 2020 net operating income.
Can I ask a question on that?
Yeah, for
sure. There ever, what is the history on putting that fire system in terms of the fire, Jefferson County Fire Rescue? Were we required to spend this money because of what they wanted on the docks?
Well, you know, I wasn't here for permitting this particular system, but in my experience, yes, as a condition of getting the permit to install floating facilities such as those that we have, we would be required to have standpipes and a way for the fire department to essentially pull up to the head of the dock, hook up their pumper truck and whatever their water source is, and get water fully pressurized throughout the dock so they could fight fire on vessels anywhere in the marina. So I think it is, you know, without knowing the specifics on this one, I would say I'm 99% confident that that would be a requirement of occupancy. And I don't know, Les, if you have anything you might add to that in your experience.
Sorry, it's getting off mute. No, that's kind of best management practice from local fire departments. And some marinas now are trying to catch back up as the codes are being up, fire codes are being updated. So I don't know, obviously, like Aaron said, but that would sure make a lot of sense.
My understanding also is that that's either an annual or biannual testing requirement. And so I'll sort that out. And my intention would be that we will fulfill that obligation and do our testing as is required per schedule so we ensure that our system's operational.
Okay.
The next item 5 is essentially an airport recap. With the change orders that were approved, primarily the big ones involving the subsoil condition, the project budget ended up at $3,781,000. Of that, nearly $3.8 million, $47,000 is the port's local share. And of the $47,000, the 2020 budget had $8,000 in the budget, which means $39,000 was not in the budget and is captured in this model. So I would have to say an impressive return on local investment to get a $3.8 million improvement for $47,000 in local dollars, $24,000 of which was spent to pave the parking area in front of the Spruce Goose and Fueling Island and future terminal building. Item 6 is just a recognition that the model now includes the $30,000 that was granted to the port from CARES Act for JCIA operations. Item 7, also really more a note than anything that would change the model, but you're now seeing as a result of our march from accrual to cash accounting, this report includes both revenue and expenditures related to deposits, sales tax, leasehold excise tax, hotel motel tax, etc., which before you didn't see. We obviously still collected them and remitted them, but they lived on the balance sheet as opposed to right in the model front and center. And I already talked about items 8 and 9. So the upshot of the updated model is that we are again feeling like we were in April, that we can meet the commission's established target for ending fund unreserved cash. We are cautiously optimistic, of course, recognizing that this pandemic can wiggle around in lots of ways and could affect us tomorrow in a way that we haven't thought about today. But if things continue to progress as they have in the last, you know, month and a half, it looks like we'll be able to meet that target. Are there any questions I can answer for you, or Abigail can answer for you?
I want to commend, make sure you pass on to Chris Sparks for his ability and being able to look at our maintenance and our fire suppression and be able to take care of that and work with you on that. Really great appreciation for saving us a lot of money and using our team, our maintenance team so well. Thank you.
Yeah, the maintenance team continues to do yeoman service on for the port, and we really appreciate that.
I'll pass that along, and you know, I'm particularly excited about this. If this works, you know, it just becomes part of what we do on an annual calendar basis, and we should find ourselves not in the position of needing a quantum leap, but we'll just be plodding along, spending and investing as we need to. And our tenants will be happy.
And your commissioners.
Happy commissioners.
You're so important, you know.
Thank you so much, Aaron. And thank you, Abigail, are you going to talk about your financial stuff next?
No.
Okay.
No, we were just wondering if there are any questions.
Excellent work. It's stellar. Thank you.
Thank you.
Pete, you're on mute.
Moving on to the Enduris annual renewal update with Joe Davis.
And Joe, I see you're on the screen, but you're on mute and without video. Hey, there you are.
I'm here. Hey, everybody. I was thanks for fixing my technology issue. I'm kind of a baseball fan, and I felt like I was just kind of warming up in the bullpen for a while. It's okay. My arm's loose now, and ready to talk about insurance. Thanks for having me on the call. First of all, really appreciate it. We're overdue to talk in this workshop. I know that, and I was supposed to be there in person, and I think it was the second week of March or something like that, right, Abigail? And then something happened. I thought this outbreak might last 2, maybe 3 weeks. And I just kind of told Abigail and Jim, well, you know, I'll be back soon. We'll work this out. We have lots of time before your renewal to take a look at things. And here we are. It's July, and I don't know. We're hanging out, in the basement of my own home here, and looks like some of you are working from home as well. So Enduris hasn't missed a minute, and it sounds like your operations are going along as well. I'm sure everybody has some disruption going on to different extents, but. I don't know. Were you guys talking about maintenance and fire suppression just because you know the insurance guy was listening today? That was good stuff. I appreciate what you're doing. I had a few exhibits, and if I'm able to share my screen, I'll go ahead and do that and just kind of walk through a PowerPoint slide and I'll admit I'm kind of an old-fashioned guy, you know. I like person-to-person meetings, and I don't like script. And today I'm not in person, and I got to go off my script. So we'll see how we do here. Let's see. Am I sharing the screen now yet? You can. Well, I had it up for a second.
Yeah, it's up. We can see it.
Okay, wonderful. I haven't shared a screen on Zoom. I've participated in some Zoom calls, but have not shared my screen yet. So far, so good, right? So Port-au-Prince Townsend has been insured with Enduris since 2001. We really appreciate this partnership. We're reaching 20 years on this upcoming renewal working together. My name is Joe Davis, and I guess I didn't start out that way. I've been the risk manager at Enduris. I'm on my fourth year at Enduris now. I've been working in insurance pretty much all my working life now. Enduris is a wonderful employer that works with governmental entities, and we work with over 50 ports through the state of Washington. And when I do get around, I do spend a lot of my time walking around with ports and reviewing their coverage. So I appreciate the opportunity to work together. Real quick, whoever's in charge of the meeting, can you let me know how much time we're going to put into this? I want to make sure I'm working in a budget, okay?
Well, that would probably be me. I don't know. How long do you think you're going to take, Joe?
Well, you know, Reader's Digest or War and Peace, you know, I can start rolling through this thing and get through this PowerPoint in about 15 or 20 minutes. But really, my goal is to give you a better understanding of your coverage and help get you to a better place. And as long as I'm doing that, we're good. I just want to work within your time, okay?
Why don't we shoot for 15 minutes and then 5 of question and answer?
All right. That sounds real good. Thank you. So for those of you who are unfamiliar with Enduris and coverage and insurance and things like that, I'm going to begin from the beginning. Enduris is your coverage provider, but we're not an insurance company. We're a joint self-insured risk pool authorized by the state of Washington, and we've been around since '87. We are government insuring government. We actually report to the state risk manager, and that's the Department of Enterprise Services, not the insurance commissioner, where, you know, maybe your home or automobile or business insurance is all regulated through the insurance commissioner. We're a joint self-insured entity, and you're one of our members that's part of this joint plan. We group together all of our risk from our 550 different clients that we work with, who are our members, and we go out to the reinsurance market and purchase coverage, and then we allocate that coverage and we pass it along to our membership, and it's a lot different from a commercial insurance policy where you got to qualify as an individual risk entity and you live and die by that every year. We try, and our goal is to use our mass purchasing power to purchase responsibly large limits of insurance at a discounted rate and pass that along to our members. So we have about 550 members. 17 different types of districts. You're a port. You're one of those 17 types. We retain 99% of our members. That's phenomenal. When they told me that when I was interviewing at Enduris about 5 years ago, I had a hard time believing that. The insurance industry is pretty happy when you're somewhere around 75-80%. So membership, definitely has its advantages, and everybody has a little bit of skin in the game, and they share each other's burden in a way. Our annual contribution level is about $15 million. Over time, we've grown our assets to 13.3. I think it's actually a little greater than that right now. That's our goal is to put together, not to make a great profit, but to put 5% of our contributions from our members aside to pay for future losses and grow the pool by 5% each year. Because every once in a while, you're going to have a bad year and you draw from those assets. Out of our members, we have about $4.3 billion of property insured, and that's only in the state of Washington. So that's, you know, you're a big part of that. Port of Port Townsend has about, $50 million of that, $4.3 billion in property. We're lean and mean. We have 15 staff members. So we're a small organization. We all work together. We collaborate. We know each other. We have board of directors that are made of our membership. And our board of directors, are represented from all different types of members that are insured with Enduris. We have a couple of ports represented on our board. Port of Skagit and Port of Olympia have a seat at the board. And down at the bottom there is Cheryl Brandt, our executive director, who I report to. This is a coverage page. And Abigail, were you able to share those exhibits like the binder, the property schedule?
No.
Okay. I'd be
that was in my package.
But we have those in our package, Joe.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, you can look at this slide, but I might refer to the binder a little bit if we dig a little deeper. This is a lot of the coverage you'll see on that binder document. Your existing policy that you're in right now renews on September 1st, and we have a $20 million general liability policy, and that general liability includes other forms of liability such as automobile, E&O coverage for public officials, E&O, and that's coverage for the port's elected officials. $20 million limit for that as well, and then we also carry cyber liability, which is one of our fastest emerging claims right now. We carry you with a $20 million each occurrence limit. For general liability and automobile, we have no aggregate, which means you can rack up as many $20 million claims as you want. That's why I explained we have really broad coverage. You don't share that $20 million with any other member at Enduris. And you can actually repeat that multiple times throughout the year. Most insurers have an aggregate, and generally what I see is about a $1 million limit and a $2 million aggregate, and that's what you'd have in the bank for the year. Quite a bit of a different structure in a risk pool. Your responsibility is your deductible. And the deductible is $1,000, and we'll pick it up from there. Now this is a good place to pause if you have any questions about your general liability coverage, and I'd be glad to take a question or two if you'd like to ask anything, or we can just wait till the end.
Where is your $1,000 deductible listed on your? On this page I'm looking at page 27.
Page 27 of?
Well, it's the document that was handed to us.
It's called the binder on the top there. That's what.
Oh, okay. Okay. Sorry, I don't have the packet, so I didn't know what page 27 was. I believe the deductibles are enumerated on a separate page from the binder, but I'm just going to go to that binder real quick.
I know the deductibles are on the right-hand side of the binder on page 27, and I think the one that matches what was just on the screen is under the lines that's called named position coverage with faithful performance of duty. Is that right, Joseph?
The $1,000, okay, well, you found me with the typo there. You have a $5,000 general liability deductible, and I apologize for that.
That was my confusion. Thank you.
Yeah, no, you're right. And then on crime, you have a $1,000 deductible.
Right.
So if I'm sharing the screen now, and sorry, I don't usually use that PowerPoint. I'm usually going through the binder. The general liability, the auto, et cetera, you have a $5,000 deductible. My apologies. Okay. Going back to, and the $1,000 deductible is Enduris' standard deductible. Most of our members have that $1,000 deductible. So, but you bought up and you pay a lower rate for that. And I fixed it on the property page though. So on your property summary, the Enduris pool ensures We go out and purchase $1 billion of coverage in the insurance market. They give us a rate for that, and we allocate that to our membership. So that's your property insurance, and then also in your documents, you'll see a list of your assets that you have insured. You'll see an extensive list of your assets insured. It's multiple pages. So if you're wondering what we're covered for, if you see it on there and it's got a value next to it on that property schedule, that's what you're insuring. And I'd be glad to switch over to that page to get more in depth. We cover $1 billion for the entire pool, and then a supplement of flood and earthquake coverage, and that's shared within the pool again. You have a blanket property limit of over $50 million at Port of Port Townsend. We take all of your assets, add them up, and you have a blanket limit, and that's what we draw from. And you're covered at replacement costs. So if you have a cause of loss that's covered by the policy of Enduris, we're going to either fix it or replace it with something brand new of like kind and quality. The definition of replacement cost is replacing brand new with like kind and quality. So we won't subtract depreciation out of your loss, but we try to make you whole again. And again, the deductible page on this PowerPoint's correct on property. You have a $5,000 property deductible. The $250 deductible is for auto physical damage, and that's your comp and collision on your vehicles. You're bonded. So that's a blanket bond. The limit's $250,000. So you're bonded at $250,000. I work most closely at Port of Port Townsend with Abigail, and I know she's your financial officer. So just speaking for Abigail, she's bonded up to $250,000. But likewise, anyone that represents your organization as an employee or elected official is also bonded to that limit. So it's called a blanket bond, covers everybody. We don't name names on the policy. So if you have a change in commissioners at some point, we don't need that reported to us for them to be covered by this bond. You have a $1,000 deductible on your blanket bond, and we do carry limits. We have limits available up to $1 million. Cyber liability. Yeah, your port has a $2 million aggregate limit if you have a cyber breach. And that's a breach of personal identifiable information, where you're required by state law to provide notifications and certain types of indemnifications or steps notification. Enduris will respond to these claims, and we'll pay for notification costs. We've had these claims where we pay for notification costs and purchase credit monitoring for a period of time on behalf of those who may have been breached or were breached. The list of coverages, I mean, these cyber thieves are getting just kind of more and more clever. We'll cover extortion. You've probably heard the terrible stories about people's data being encrypted if they click the wrong thing. Then all of a sudden you have a demand for a bunch of bitcoins. We've paid a couple losses out in Bitcoin now too. That's been kind of a new thing for the industry. And to kind of go hand in hand with that, we also purchase a traveler's insurance product for all of our members, and this covers our members, their employees, their household relatives. We've had, and I'm not sure if that happened in your organization or if you're aware of it, but there's been a lot of unemployment fraud going on in the state. That's been in the news, and a lot of news alerts have gone out on unemployment fraud against individuals. And if you had anybody in your organization that's an employee or elected official that went through that, you can actually turn in a claim on this traveler's product that Enduris purchases, and they would respond to any kind of actual fraud that you're experiencing out of this. And a lot of that information gets sold on the dark web, and so it may not be over yet. A lot of individuals that were affected by this. But this product has been one of our more widely used products over the last 60 days, and just one of those unanticipated effects out of the COVID outbreak.
Hey, Joe, I'm going to jump on you. You're going to have to pick it up a little bit. We've got one other presentation to go after you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, we're about there. We manage claims in-house, so we have a lot of authority in-house, and if you do have a claim, we can work towards one-on-one consultations and settlements in-house. We're not really beholden to our reinsurers unless we're getting into claims in the higher six figures to $1 million plus. Some of our risk control services, I'm just going to highlight those real quick. We have a pre-defense program that we have an employee on staff who is an attorney, a claims attorney, and Kelly's been working very, very robustly with our members on proactive employment-related practices issues. So if you have anything to consult with, get in touch with Susan or Kelly. At Enduris, we review contracts for insurance and indemnification requirements, and that can go both ways, whether you're providing insurance for other organizations or they're providing them for you. That's one of my responsibilities. MRSC, if you're familiar with MRSC, Enduris retains MRSC, where our members can ask a question. And if you haven't been on their website lately, they have a litany of great resources on the COVID shutdown and how that's affecting governments, and a lot of great advice. Training seminars, if you haven't been a user of training seminars, I'd encourage you to do that. And Enduris, go on our website. Enduris has a lot of good training seminars going on this this summer. We just wrapped up a three-part series called Building Supervisory Skills on a 201 level, and we're graduating to 301 shortly. Good news, if you missed 201, you can still take 301 if you'd like. That's at no cost. We have a DVD library and something called Online University that can help you in your HR training and some of your mandatory check-the-box HR things. And if you have any questions about Online University, just reach out to myself or Cindy Joseph in our office. And that's the PowerPoint. I'll set aside and take any questions, but I appreciate your time. Wish I could be there in person. Look forward when I will be able to be.
I've got two questions. The first, and Abigail, maybe you can jump in here as well. So we did suffer a loss with our 70-ton lift in January, I believe that was 2017.
Right.
And, two things happened. One, we did not get our lift restored until the end of June of that year. And we suffered a loss of revenue, and it was a unacceptable time period for that claim to be processed. And I think as a commissioner, I really need to understand why that took so long on the insurance company's part and how we can remedy that so it doesn't happen again.
Yeah, I don't know too many details about that claim. I believe that occurred before I was an employee at Enduris, but I was kind of there at the end of it, and I, even though I'm not managing claims, I guess what I can say is we had a claims adjuster that got fired within about a year of that incident, and it probably was mishandled. I don't know all the details. I'd be glad to search it out and have a conversation with you. Over that, that's the facts, though.
Yeah.
Actually, it was, excuse me, Commissioner Henke, that was the claims manager that got let go, is the one that was handling that claim.
Right. And I think in the future, Joe, the concern I have is, if we have another similar loss where a strap breaks or something catastrophic happens with a travel lift, that's our bread and butter. It's like an airplane with its wings, and if we don't have our wings, we can't fly. So I guess the assurance that it will be handled in a timely manner the next time, that was a hugely frustrating experience to sit there month after month asking the deputy director, what's going on? And he's like, oh, well, we're trying to figure it out. And it didn't go well.
Well, I appreciate the feedback. And I apologize for all the disruption on that. My coming in at the end of that, I could tell that there were some things going on that weren't right. And he didn't make it for much longer after that. I have full faith in our director of claims. Her name is Susan Looker. She's been working in risk pools for over 25 years. She's really ramped up our best practices and policies, and we have a whole new claims department. We've added Kelly Looker, who's a really a top level attorney. Just kind of in a phasing out of life, and he's just kind of working at Enduris as a hobby, I think, right now. He wants to transition into retirement, and we got him part time right now, and so we actually have an attorney on staff, Susan, as well, and two other claims handlers that are working property and liability, and they're on top of it. I could say with great confidence that you wouldn't have to be dragged through that again. And my influence at Enduris wouldn't allow that to happen. I mean, nobody came to me about it, and I wasn't going to be able to send you bags of money, but my influence would have made a difference in that too. we're much, much different than we were 5 years ago.
And then another question is our fuel tank at the airport. And we kind of went around and around on that with Enduros last summer. Got a notice with 30 days term on it that we were going to lose our insurance on the fuel tank. And that was because paperwork had been lost in the process. And I kind of don't remember our discussion, Abigail. We talked about this last week, didn't we? And I guess the upshot is, you know, fuel at the airport or fuel anywhere is really important, particularly at the airport, because if a plane lands and they don't have enough fuel to take off, they're pretty toast. And so I just want to make sure that we're all good to go on that and that we've got a plan going forward so that we're not surprised again.
Yeah, that one kind of threw us off because Abigail was I got to commend Abigail for doing incredible work on that. She really took the bull by the horns and got moving on the information that we really needed, and a lot of that policy needed to be rebuilt because some of that information that we did have was not represented correctly, and when Abigail fixed it, it made your fuel tank ineligible. That's not her fault. That was just the facts. And everybody was caught off guard with that. Our Enduros is not your insurance provider for your fuel tanks. We run that through a broker because we don't insure underground fuel tanks for compulsory pollution laws. So we were doing a lot of orchestration, a lot of dancing. I was checking with every resource that I had in the Pacific Northwest to try to help you find coverage on that. And in the end, through Abigail's help, she was really a champion on this. We were able to get it done. I want to give Abigail a lot of the credit for it, and not what Enduros did or the brokerage did, but we worked pretty furiously trying to find resources and alternative markets. No insurer wanted to touch that fuel tank if they felt like it was about to be disturbed, and that was the port's plan, was to get a grant and pull it out. And if the policy's in place, they can't cancel it over that. But if there's no policy in place, they'll never touch it because there's too high a risk when a fuel tank that's old is disturbed because they might find a latent condition or a leak may occur. It was complex insurance. And the circumstances were pretty extraordinary. I've never gone through that before in my insurance career, and hopefully not again. But Abigail carried the water on that. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. You survived the fire.
Oh, the hot seat's fine. Like I said at the beginning, my goal is to get you a little better understanding of your insurance coverage and help put you in a better place. And I think we have some reviews to do. I was, you know, when I was coming out in March, I was going to do some boots on the ground work with you guys and just try to work on some solutions because there's a few things that we probably need to take a look at out there. That's one of my job responsibilities. So I look forward to getting out there. I like to visit our members.
Look forward to meeting you.
Yeah, thank you, Pete.
Any comments from staff? No? You guys are all good? Okay, so we'll move on. Thank you very much, Joe.
Thank you, my pleasure.
Okay, everybody have a good afternoon.
You too.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So we're on to point C with Brian, EDC Team Jefferson, semi-annual report. And there he is. Nice background. I like it.
Thank you. Yeah, the cloud looked like our logo, too, so I had to take a picture. So, anyway, I appreciate your time, President Hanke and Aaron, for fitting me on the agenda. I know this isn't any kind of a contractual requirement, but given the fact that Port is also commissioned for economic development, I want to make sure we keep our activities close to the to yours, keep you all informed of what we're doing, and more importantly, seek your input and direction where you see things that are needed or support that may be needed. So I started off by just putting together a summary of activity, and in case you're wondering of the format, and I guess just to pause real quick, did y'all get that one-page summary to look at? It wasn't included in your packet, but just something I put together earlier today.
I'll get it. Brian, did you send it to my email?
I sent it to Karen, so she may have pushed that out. So if not now, I can summarize some of the activity. And you can definitely.
I did send it out, Brian, just so you know. And it's also on the website. So.
Oh, great. Thank you.
It went out at after 11 this morning.
All right.
Okay. So it just shows some of the regular activity that we continue to do as part of our funding contract with the Department of Commerce at the state, and capturing some of the metrics of, you know, the normal course of business of an EDC, which largely consists of the term I use with businesses or folks who don't know what economic developers do is, you know, serving as that connective tissue between public resources and private businesses.
So, hey, Brian.
Yes, sir.
Can I hold you up for just a second?
Yes.
So does everybody have this report in front of them? Commissioners?
I do.
Yeah, I've got it here.
Okay. All right. There you go. So we're all good.
Okay. Thanks, Pete. So really just showcasing kind of that day in, day out activity, which is used to be across the desk. Now it's, you know, virtually via camera. In a fake background of, you know, connecting with business owners and answering their questions. And those come in certainly unsolicited all the time, and we also seek to proactively reach out to various businesses and sectors to check in on how they're doing. Now, since I was in front of you all last, obviously, as Joe mentioned, our world's changed. The big thing happened, and so that's certainly been reflective in some of the additional tasks or activities that I've summarized for y'all as well, and really just focused on the responsiveness to, you know, requests for assistance that people have had, including processing grants. So before I touch on those, one thing to mention, too, is kind of the bottom category of the summary for commerce that says readiness and capacity asset building. That's their term for essentially critical conversations. So, you know, that can take place in, you know, multiple formats. An example would be, you know, having a discussion with the county about propping up a Jefferson County micro grant program for businesses, which is something we're working on, and can also include other critical conversations with stakeholders about resources for businesses. I think as Bill mentioned ahead of this meeting, we were talking about broadband, and that's one of those sort of discussions that we're happy to help continue to host. So some key activities I wanted to point out, and most of all wanting to just hear your questions, what you're seeing and what questions you have. Since we set it up in April, we've had over 590 inquiries sent in to a help email address that we did in response to the COVID crisis. We wanted to have a dedicated inbox because, frankly, a lot of emails can otherwise get lost. And since we're a 1.5 FTE organization, you know, there's occasionally capacity issues to make sure that we can handle everything. So that's important to us. We've also received nearly 200 calls for assistance from various businesses and stakeholders. And so while that's extremely busy for this period and comparative to previous periods, I think it's pretty indicative of you know, where businesses are and a lot of concerns and questions folks have had. Specifically one, and Pete, you and I had a chance to talk about this a little while ago, is the clunky nature in which a lot of programs came online. So the way I would phrase it is good intention coming out of either DC or Olympia, being pushed through very rigid and monolithic channels. And that's just my assessment. So take that with a grain of salt. So a lot of unknowns. You know, if you recall early on, there was a common talking point that each business in the country would get a $10,000 grant. And that narrative shifted as the SBA updated their evaluation criteria, and it still manifested in grants to businesses, but that was an example of a lot of confusion and, you know, tumult in the business community as a result. Certainly the SBA programs for the economic injury disaster loans, those had a bumpy start at first and kind of had fits and starts along the way. So we really did a lot of work acting as a touch point for a lot of business owners. You know, a very common story both with the SBA and at the state with the unemployment office when those resources were coming online was calling and nobody answering the phone, or, you know, I even tried it myself and was on hold for a couple hours and then it hung up. So confirming that the rumors were true. So, we acted and continue to act as, you know, a touch point, for businesses, just looking for a human being, even if it's a human being that says, I don't know the answer, but I'm going to go find it for you and I'll get that to you.
Do you know how many of those grants were actually received in Jefferson County?
Are you referring to the Working Washington grants or the
the federal
PPP?
Yeah.
I have data on the PPP that I'm going to share. This is pre-press release, so you'll hear it here first at the Port Commission meeting. but before I do that, just mention, I don't have information on those EIDL grants. So those were the very small dollar amount grants that went to businesses, either sole proprietors or employees. But I can speak to the PPP loans in just a second.
I will throw out that Brian did an excellent job at that point from as a business person. You know, it was very confusing, and there were several other businesses that I was trying to get information to, and Brian did an excellent job of kind of keeping it all organized and explaining it clearly. So just a big shout out for you, Brian.
Thanks, Pete. I appreciate that. And, you know, I'll give credit to the smart people that I'm staying close to, which includes our SBDC advisor that we were able to partially fund to support Jefferson County, and also my counterparts at other organizations, including the Column EDC. So not surprising, but I was very pleased that during this this economic you know, downturn and the issues around the pandemic, really was a collaborative circling of the wagons and continues to be so to this day. But we also want to make sure we still have the right people. But I do appreciate that feedback. So another function that we serve, just as a reminder, is we act as the voluntary administrator for LION, which is our local investment network. And for anyone listening who may not be familiar with them, these are just private individuals in the community with varying degrees of wealth and an interest to support local businesses and entrepreneurs. And so we facilitate inquiries for financial support coming before LION and helping along with that process. And, you know, that's not something we collect any kind of a fee on or anything like that. We feel that is a critical resource in Jefferson County, and we're happy to be a part of that. And we certainly don't vet any opportunities either. We're always happy to meet one-on-one with individuals, but we don't serve in any sort of advisory capacity to LION members because that could run afoul pretty quick. So in the first half of this year, we helped process 35 applications for both funding and also new LION members, new individuals who have heard about the organization and wanting to participate. One grant program, and talk about a clunky deployment, and that's a conversation we're having across the state, is the Working Washington Small Business Emergency Grant Program. This is the one that Governor Inslee funded from the Strategic Reserve Fund that he has discretionary access to. That's a portion of unclaimed lottery winnings. He funded or allotted $5 million to that program, and then the Department of Commerce was able to seek out an additional $5 million So we processed over 220 applications for Jefferson County. That was a very paper-centric manual process that we certainly learned from, and so have some good recommendations on the next grant phases moving forward. And in collaboration with the Department of Commerce, who chose the final recipients, we are in the process of processing 85 grant awards. That's twice the number of awardees that even Collin County had, which is reflective of a desire to kind of spread the grant funds around a little further. And time will tell, hopefully not too thin. You know, we wanted to take an approach that was more, frankly, burdensome from an administrative standpoint, but touched more businesses in the community. And so that's something we're working on as we speak. In fact, as soon as I'm done here, I'll be jumping right into that.
Can you remind us of what the total that was awarded to Jefferson County is?
Yeah, it was $154,000 and change. So forgive me, Pam, on the change. I think perhaps
that's $154,000.
Yeah.
And do you know what business sectors, or can you give us an idea of how that was distributed?
Absolutely. And I can share with y'all the list of awardees and give you an idea. We didn't break them out by NACE codes. I can say that 8 of the awardees are port tenants. So these are folks very near and dear to the port. Business sectors, they range pretty widely. There was a number of restaurants who received funding. There was professional service businesses that received funding, a couple of dental offices that received the grants, manufacturers, like I mentioned, maritime trade or port tenants, I guess is what I mentioned, which include rigging companies and supply companies, maritime supply companies. So those are just a handful, but I'd be happy to follow up and give you all a comprehensive list.
Thank you.
Is there any sense about how widely that was spread in terms of, you know, where the funds went on a countywide basis?
Yeah, there isn't. Again, I can follow up with more specificity, but that was something that we stressed pretty heavily to Commerce, is we wanted to see geographic diversity. Yeah, absolutely. You know, at least a third, if not half, were in the Port Townsend proper area. But there were recipients in Brennan, Quilcene, Nordland, Chimicum, I believe Discovery Bay as well. Forgive me if I'm incorrect on that. But there was a good degree of diversity geographically. Pound for pound, I couldn't say specifically if it matched, you know, kind of concentration of businesses as well.
Was agriculture included in that?
Yes, thanks, Bill. Great question. There were at least one, if not two, meat producers and 3 or 4 farms that you would recognize definitely down in the Chimicum Valley area.
So that's
great. Thanks.
Okay, and it's about, if you divide 154 by those 85 businesses, you get 1,800 per business. Was it distributed equally, or were there some that may have gotten more or less?
Yeah, great question. Commerce did have awards to some businesses that were more than others. The ones that received more, I can say pretty confidently, without having the info in front of me, that they were, they employed more people. And so that, I believe, was a large basis of the difference in those numbers. There was a number of sole proprietors who applied, and the application was for up to 10,000. If anyone recalls seeing it. That was a statewide standard application, and so the vast majority of folks who applied just check that box versus putting in a lesser dollar amount. And I do want to mention, too, because I think this really speaks to the ethos of the community, there were a number of businesses I spoke to who were looking at applying for the grant program but recognized even before that there was a scarcity of funds and proactively chose not to apply recognizing peer businesses that just didn't have the depth of resources that they perhaps had, or the professional capacity to pursue some of the other programs available. And so that was pretty unique. And talking with my colleagues across the state, which I do on a weekly basis, that wasn't entirely unheard of, but it's not common. And so I want to share that with you just to speak to the character of this community, which obviously all three of the commissioners are an integrated part of. And also let you know, too, that we had five businesses who were awarded grants who said, I'm doing a lot better than I thought I would be. And so please go ahead and pass that along to the next business on the list. So I'm in process with Commerce on that right now. Those next people on the list haven't been notified yet, just because that has to go through the approval process with the governor. But I should have, a handful of phone calls that I get to make. And that's directly the result of local business owners who, recognize that they're doing okay, or they were able to access another program and wanting to share that financial love elsewhere. So that's been pretty neat to see, to say the least. So summary of the PPP loans. So the Paycheck Protection Program loans, which is one of those other resources many businesses got to access. I did an update to that spreadsheet while watching the evening news last night. So these are hot off the press numbers. For Jefferson County, there were 483 PPP loans made, totaling $24.9 million. And the stated preservation of jobs was 3,384 jobs in our county. So needless to say, that is a pretty significant impact to Jefferson County businesses. And the PPP loans, just as a reminder, because I do not want to steal any thunder with that, that was not a program that the EDC administered in any way, other than providing a number of businesses just technical support or getting them connected with PPP lenders as those came and went. Because many lenders came online, then stopped their applications as the dust settled, and then came back online. So given my history as a commercial lender, I tried to avail myself of those relationships to stay informed of who was taking what applications. And so did direct people in the right direction, but credit really goes obviously to the SBA and to those overwhelmed business lenders out there who were responding to the deluge of inquiries they received. Just to close out with an update of a few other activities that we've been doing despite the COVID. So we continue to host the Jefferson Broadband Action Team, which was recently pulled out of a brief hiatus in response to the ICC directive. I think that's next on the agenda for an update, so Aaron may give an update about that, but broadband was certainly a key pillar focus and something that we've helped hopefully give some shape to in setting that table. Each month we bring together the CEO breakfast, which has been sans breakfast the last few months for obvious reasons, and tomorrow morning we'll have our legislative reps be joining us for that discussion. So he'll hear directly from them about what's going on in Olympia and what we should expect is coming down the pike. If you're at all interested in jumping in on that, please talk with Aaron and he can get you connected, or let me know, and we'd love to have you join us. The other things we continue to bring together is the Five Things meeting, and then also in collaboration with the Column EDC and other agencies, the North Olympic Legislative Alliance. And that's something we're able to do and support financially to make sure our voice is heard in Olympia. We also, with the Chamber, are co-hosting the Business Revitalization Task Force, which is also a subset of that ICC in regard to helping businesses reopen, stay healthy, keep themselves healthy and their customers healthy. And output of that has been the Jeffco Cares Initiative, which you've certainly heard of, and that's been led by the Chamber specifically. And then again, continuing to collaborate with other agencies across the peninsula and throughout the state, which includes, again, the Column EDC, the North Olympic Development Council,
WEDA, which is our state economic development organization, and others. So I guess I'll close by saying for a lot of folks, you may see online that people are saying if they're having to work from home and gosh, they're awfully bored, but there's been no quiet moment for any of you and certainly for us at the EDC during this COVID crisis. And again, looking forward to your questions, your direction in terms of what you're seeing as commissioners and also business owners. And with that, I will defer to your questions.
Brian, you had an interview a couple of weeks ago with your board member, KPTZ Paul Rice. And
yes.
On there, a couple of questions were asked. And one of them was, what sectors have been more stable through the COVID? And you mentioned one sector, and I'm just wondering why you just mentioned high tech, and if maybe there were some other sectors that could have been mentioned that you may know of.
Oh, thanks for catching that, Pam. I remember the question, and, you know, tech-related businesses, or frankly, businesses that have been operating virtually were probably the most resilient against a lot of the COVID issues. Another one, too, and I haven't had a chance to listen to his interview yet, is our mutual friend Pete Langley, who was on the same show last Friday. He's communicated a degree of stability throughout this downturn. His biggest issue, has been, you know, obviously distancing requirements and things like that. But in terms of demand for activity, he's communicated that the demand remains strong, and certainly he's a proponent of onshoring production of, you know, metal items and things like that. The sectors that have definitely been hit the hardest, is no surprise, is certainly our tourism-related businesses, so hospitality, retail businesses, businesses that were mandated to shut down and simply could not bring people on. You know, others that I'd be interested to hear from, I've spoken to a handful of businesses in the marine trade sector and hear varying results. Some say, you know, hey, we're back to work. There was a brief hiatus, you know, but we're moving, we're getting things done. Others have mentioned, like Pete, have said, you know, there really hasn't been much break in activity. We're just learning how to adapt in the new normal.
Would be good to walk through the yard once in a while. And it was pretty active in March, April, May, June. There's been a lot of boats and workers, and certainly starting the essential workers never stopped. And that was commercial fishing. Or yeah. Any commercial boat. And so there's been a lot of activity. It's a lot of stability for many of the businesses throughout this whole thing. And certainly a lot of businesses have chose to scale way back so that yeah. They can take care of safety first with distancing and everything.
Yeah, absolutely. And on the latter point, you know, that harkened to a marine trades business I spoke to, you know, who does rigging work, and that was a concern of theirs. It certainly wasn't a lack of demand for their services, but it was just that precipice of staying busy, but also focusing on the safety of their employees and obviously trying to be responsive to some of the ambiguity of directives that were coming out. So. Yeah, that's great to hear, too.
Brian, what's the makeup of the EDC governing board now?
Yeah, we've continued to add new board members. So some of our newest additions have included Tammy. Oh, this is embarrassing. I'm going to forget last names. Tammy with yes, thank you. Tammy.
How about just organizations?
Just organizations represented. Okay, so we have software and tech with a couple of the positions. We have marine trades with Pete, as I mentioned, Langley, real estate and development with Paul Rice and Heather Dudley Nolette. We are actively seeking an agricultural sector representative to assist. And frankly, not to get tangential on you, but one of the kind of the benefits of the new norm of us doing more things virtually is that may help significantly with getting folks who have been otherwise concerned about the time commitment to be part of the board. We're also looking for natural resources sector. Obviously, forestry is a huge part of the Jefferson County economy, and so that's another sector we're looking for. Back to representation, manufacturing with our now past president with Olympic Research, and then healthcare as well. Amy Gailey is on our board representing the healthcare sector, and certainly tourism focus or sector with Arlene from the Chamber of Commerce. So we are still looking for additional participants. And since you mentioned the board, even though by design we are a private nonprofit, and the main benefit of that in this model is being able to keep discussions and information we share with private businesses confidential and not a part of public record. Our meetings are absolutely open to anyone interested to participate. Bill, I think it was serendipitous one time you were in the office and I said, hey, we're having a board meeting. Sit down, have some free food. So,
I think it was donuts, I think, even.
I think I had donut holes. It's a volunteer board, so I try and keep them at least fed and get them good coffee from local roasters. But all joking aside, anytime anyone's interested to drop in, you're absolutely welcome. You need no invitation, but you're welcome anytime. There may only be a period that we'd ask to keep off the record, just sharing confidential information about either recruitment activity or things like that. But we'd certainly let you know.
Do you have any representation from District 3?
At this time, we do not. So that is another geographic area that we are reaching out to try and recruit. We've had District 3 representatives in the past, but from what I've heard, having talked to some of them, frankly, traveling up to the northern part of the county was challenging for them. So hence my optimism about being able to recruit folks not only from southern Jefferson County, but even perhaps from our stakeholders in West Jefferson County. They're certainly a part of this economy and represent the tribal connections we have, too, with our friends at the Ho Tribe.
Just on a kind of a parting note, I had scribbled down a note about the next JBAT meeting, and then I saw something come across that it seems to have been canceled or moved, or if you get a chance, could you keep me in the loop about when that next JBAT / work group meeting is?
Yes, absolutely. There was an invite that just went out, which was a misfire from one of the well-intentioned members of the JBAT group. They attempted to flag something on their calendar, and it sent out an invite to the rest of us. But that was not the correct time, although I think that's still the day that we're targeting, Friday the 17th. But we'll get that sent out quickly.
Thanks.
You bet.
All set?
Any other questions? All right. I appreciate your time, and just something to leave you with. The last time we spoke together, started a discussion about the future of the ADO designation and where that should be for our community. I've mentioned to Aaron that I'd like to, start that dialogue in a meaningful and thoughtful way, certainly not shy away from it, of what makes sense for Jefferson County. And I know my board is equally open and wanting to participate with that too. So as your commission sees fit to advance that narrative, we're here ready and willing to do so as well.
That's great. That's great to hear, Brian.
Is there an EDC Team Jefferson mailing list?
Email list?
Email list, yeah.
Yes, absolutely. We restarted our email list. It had been sunsetted for a little bit in the hopes of streamlining with the chamber, but given the COVID situation, we re-engaged that, and so we have been pushing out messages, and unless I hear protests otherwise, I'll make sure you are all added to it.
You want me? Yeah, subscribe me.
You're right.
You got it.
Great, Brian. Thank you very much. Have a great day. We'll talk soon.
Appreciate your time.
Okay. All right, so we're moving on to point D, ICC updates. Aaron, do you want to take on this?
Sure, I can get started, and then maybe you can wrap it up.
Sure.
So we had our first ICC meeting, and most of the time in the meeting was spent going over in detail what the scope of work for each of the six community groups would be. And then the ICC assigned a liaison from itself to each of the six groups and kind of further discussed since these groups are self-forming and self-directed, how does the ICC liaise with them and support them and help them get to a finish line that will be useful in the ICC's work in developing an actual draft plan to take to the IGC. And then the last bit of work was agreeing to a schedule of meetings and time, which our next meeting will be on July 23rd, and the meeting times are at 5 p.m. So I think that's kind of the high-level ICC update, as I recall it. I don't know, Commissioner, if you've got something else to add or some more detail.
Yeah, I would just – so, you know, because of our situation as commissioners, you know, your liaisons in terms of who's going to be contacting you from the ICC, it'll not be me. It'll be someone else because of the two-commissioner situation. I think – The main discussion that I found a little troubling and hopefully a little positive, I don't know, is because we're trying to move this information from the bottom up, from the public up, there isn't a lot of structure in how this is going to happen. And so, I mean, some of the committees are well formed. I mean, there are groups that we will plug into that you both are members of, broadband or food resiliency, but there are other groups that, you know, we're just kind of hoping will develop or matriculate out of kind of something. And I think that's the part where, you know, one, what's going to develop, and two, what will be constructive coming out of that group for us to work with. And so, I know several times Commissioner Dean, County Commissioner Dean, expressed, you know, a little concern that if we had our druthers, we would probably be organizing more from the top down in terms of a government, what we're looking for, but that's not really what we're trying to do. We're trying to move it from the bottom up. So I guess that's my only comment, that for you being on three of these committees, it'll be interesting to, or four, is your three? Committees. Looks like four. So it'll be interesting to see how that develops, moving that information up.
Pete, are there any examples of, back to that question, what are we looking for? Was there any discussion on that?
So the ICC did talk about very briefly a sort of chapter outline for the type of product that they might hope to see.
Okay.
And the so-called Four Amigos are working on, for lack of a better way to describe it, a toolkit that can be provided to community groups that kind of orients the group to, you know, what this process is, how it was formed, and what those objectives are. That would include a chapter outline. So the hope is really, you know, the ICC is not directing these groups because they're self-directed, but the groups who are forming up obviously want to be helpful and in the process. So the goal is really, the bottom line, to provide a list of questions that need to be answered in order for the ICC to get the information necessary to build the chapter on that particular sector. So that's in process right now.
I mean, more specifically, would the end goal for a group, like say I'm on the food resilience, to look at solving something countywide or to take one specific, I mean, to do a broad policy thing or to do take one specific project and see how we can move it forward?
Well, I think it could be a variety. So the key, though, is that it could be multiple recommendations that are part of this chapter dealing with food resiliency. So it could be, you know, 5 or 10 little things. It could be 2 littles in the big. It could be government, non-government, a mix of all. I mean, it's really wide open. But the key is that it's specifically tied to needs resulting from COVID and can happen quickly and is foreseeably fundable. So that's really the constraint. Otherwise, I think it's wide open for the groups to be as creative and imaginative as they can. It's just that funneling effect will occur when you consider the timing and the ability to fund. So it's not just a blue sky project, but something that we could specifically imagine happening in the months after the report is finalized.
Yeah, and, you know, Pam, I would just throw out, kind of, I seem to throw it out often in different examples. I've already thrown it out once today, is the cold storage or controlled atmosphere storage, either one. You know, I know in conversations with Keith and Christy Kissler that it's not so much pertinent, but it could be, and that is, you know, bringing food in a more consistent way throughout the year than carrots are done in July, and yet we need carrots in December. So how do we get carrots to last from July through December? And so maybe it is a joint exercise where all three bodies are coming together, city, county, and port, or four bodies and PUD, in order to help pave the way to create a cold storage for food resiliency. I don't know. See what I'm saying? As an example?
Christy's on our group, so that's great. Yes.
I think this pandemic and this projected recovery plan is bringing some focus to areas that just didn't have any immediacy associated with them. You know, local food production and distribution is certainly one of those. You know, it's kind of one of those things that really needed some direction. And it is kind of the, you know, this pandemic may be kind of the test run for things in, you know, downstream, where we really need to depend on more on our own resources than we have in the past. So, in all these sectors, I think we really are. This is forcing us to build some home resilience, and I think that's important.
You know, one I'll throw out, and I thought about this after the ICC meeting, and I was actually thinking about talking about it in commissioner comments, but I'll talk about it now. And this may be one, Aaron, for you to jot down for the Four Amigo conversation, is our solid waste. And, you know, the Jefferson Transfer Station really is abhorrent when you think about it in terms of what that does to our economy, both burning fossil fuels, distributing tire waste along the road, you know, throwing it all in a landfill that doesn't break it down at all. It's just a putting it in a big landfill down on the Columbia. So it seems like, kind of, Bill, going along with what you were just saying, this could be a golden opportunity to take a really good look at that from a body standpoint. And if you look at the six committees that we've outlined, it really doesn't fall into any of those committees, maybe economy and jobs. And so that might be something that we want to kind of think about in terms of how would we address that as a community. So there you go.
Yeah, I think it is part of a number of these categories that kind of the end product of a lot of these activities needs to be looked at as well as everything else.
And one of the complications that we've seen during this COVID is people not being maybe able to afford to take their stuff to the waste, and we're seeing a lot more on our roadsides than ever before and at our port.
Out here in the county, down in Center Valley, it's amazing how much stuff is collecting on all the logging road outlets in front of the Orange Gates. Yeah. Just a thought. So that's all I have on ICC.
Do we want to say, review which out of these six groups, which commissioner is on each? I think we have done that, but I'm not doubly sure.
The notes that I have from our last meeting had, and really our goal, since we can't really assign people, was really to assign, it's almost the reverse, it's who's not going to show up.
So,
we've got Bill on culture and events, Pam, economy and jobs, Bill again on broadband, and Pam again on food system resiliency. Pete, of course, as a member of the ICC, will be reviewing the products of all six of those community groups, and will be consulting with the two of you in an actual meeting in advance of that. So it's really just those four groups is what the commission assigned out at the last meeting.
Okay.
And then I can report, Pam, from ICC, that Children and Families and Human Services, like Ariel, jumped in on one of those as a liaison from the city council. I don't remember who did Human Services, Aaron. You?
I think Kate. What was
yes, it? I think it was Kate.
The liaison role for that one.
Right. Yeah, so those both got covered well by the ICC.
Well, and that's actually an important note that you just brought up that I hadn't mentioned earlier, which is that the composition of the ICC shifted at our first meeting. The deputy mayor, David Faber, was the city's designee. And in an effort to ensure that the ICC was a bit more representative, he swapped out for Ariel Spesser. So the city's representative is Ariel. Which does put three lawyers on, so that's kind of a lot.
Yeah, well, what can you say?
Can we start the jokes?
Are we good? Moving on.
Item E, who wants to take that?
Me.
Yeah, Pam, you're up on item E.
Okay. All right, I know that. So this is regarding the Navy right of entry. This was on the agenda sent out preceding our major three-day weekend with many people still on vacation. 5 years ago when the Navy contract was requested, it was put on the port's agenda for a first reading. It was covered by both newspapers. with the first line saying public comment was prolific. So number one, I just want to make sure that our public can participate in this process. And number two, I want to make sure that that we factor in that this is one piece of what the Navy is asking for in a much larger picture, and that we think of it in terms of what's being requested at the city level, at the county level. I am also part of the Marine Resource Committee. I'm a port representative for that. And they are the county's environmental and water person, and they would appreciate having time to look at this. Their next meeting is August 4th. There are also quarterly Navy meetings with the city and the county. Commissioner Bill and myself as a Marine Trades representative last year went to one of those, and that was really valuable to have the opportunity to meet with them. But I feel that our port should be included in those regular quarterly meetings so that we can all work together with and see the bigger picture. Kate Dean is going to check into that so that we can have better communications. I have a list of questions from constituents, and I'd like to have those questions, you know, answered or addressed by the Navy. And then I didn't have Exhibit A. It was missing in the contract. It was referred to. In combination with the Navy's request to the port for MATS, they're also making a request to Washington Parks and State Parks, and they are going through a public process. Governor Inslee has written a letter saying, what did he say? That it's in, you know, the Navy's request is incompatible with the state parks and it could adversely impact visitor experience. There were many questions raised about individual privacy rights, visitor safety and enjoyment in the natural environment. Washington Parks and Recreation is strongly encouraging consulting with, we've got the Washington State Fish and Wildlife, Natural Heritage, a tribal government. So I feel that even though they're asking for one little thing, this is part of a bigger picture that needs to be considered. Their contract is due to be renewed in January, so I feel that we should take the time to look at this as part of a bigger picture. So I'm asking for time.
Okay, this request, the Navy wanted this request executed by the 15th of July, which doesn't really give us an opportunity to have another meeting about this unless we're just going to outright say no. You know, my view of this is that for what they have outlined that they want for MATS, you know, I think it's very nice that they asked, but they didn't have to. It's a public access boat ramp and parking lot. They could just do it. And so, you know, I understand that there are community members that never want to see a uniform, never want to have anything positive done with the military. I think that's a very short-sighted, myopic perspective. And, I'm sure that I'll get quoted on that. But you know, we are a very isolated county. We really don't have much access, and I think that there'll be a time in the future when we need all the friends we can get. The Navy is likely to be one of the ones we count on. You know, I've been, in other communities where for reasons totally separate from what the Navy wanted to do, Navy or Army or, you know, any of the military branches wanted to do, people just didn't want the military around. The military kind of gave them what they asked for. And it was very unpleasant, very, divisive sort of a thing. You know, if we have a bunch of public comments, on this, I mean, I would like to hear, any substantive comments. I mean, comments that bear on the request. I'm less interested in the kind of the general, we don't like the military, position, but you know, if there are substantial reasons why we shouldn't grant this, publicly posted meeting information. We didn't have any public comment on this. If you got some, Pam, then I would encourage you to present them now. Because I haven't heard from anybody on this subject.
Okay.
Is that it, Bill?
Yeah, okay. That's my rant.
Yeah. My only two comments, one I'll start with the last of Bill's, is I would actually not encourage you to give us your comments that you have, Pam. It's not appropriate. It really has to come when we ask for public comments on the agenda. There were none. Two, in the agreement, we can cancel this agreement with 30 days notice at any time. Plus, I mean, as Bill said, we can't say no. I mean, they still come in and attack the tides in every year with a zeal at 2 a.m. in the morning. So I really don't. I mean, I think it's much ado about nothing. I don't really have a problem with this. If the homeowners around Matt's we're presenting something where they're being disturbed, they don't like this, the seals are picking their roses or something like that, then I would be more inclined to say, okay, let's take a look at this. But I've heard nothing to that degree. So with that being said, I think we have to make a motion whether to accept or not accept this agreement. Do I hear a motion for that?
I will make a motion to direct the executive director to execute this right of entry request from the U.S. Navy.
And then a second? I'll second. You'll second it? No. I'll second it. And then all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Aye. No. Yes.
Yep. One opposed. So the motion carries. Moving forward, staff comments.
All right. Well, I've got a few comments for you today. Number one, I got to take a tour of the Coast Seafoods operation, both their fee tenant, their freehold interest, and their tenancy this morning. And I found that to be very interesting. I don't know. So Commissioner Henke was with me and took the tour. I don't know if the other two commissioners have had that opportunity yet. Have you not? You haven't, Pam? Have you, Bill?
I've been around parts of it. I've never had a detailed tour.
It's fascinating.
If it's okay with the two of you, I'd sure be interested to probably just do two more tours and get you over there one-on-one to see what they're doing. It's pretty interesting. I get just a couple observations from the tour today. They've been doing the hatchery work there for almost 50 years. They started that in the 70s. They were farming that location, I think, back into the 50s. And the hatchery seems like a hodgepodge, and it really is, because it has grown up over the course of these five decades as they, kind of invented this industry and imagined the solutions and identified the issues and found the science to solve it. But really what you see there fundamentally is a combination of laboratories designed to study creatures, a whole bunch of tanks to make algae of, I think, four different varieties or three different varieties, and then just a whole series of different tanks that grow oysters at different stages of development. But really pretty remarkable. That ties into a tour I took yesterday with the Jamestown Sklallam tribe of their Flupsy, which is the floating, a floating upweller system for growing oysters once they get to a certain stage at John Wayne Marina in Sequim. So I guess it's all about seafood production for me this week and how that works in shellfish land. I heard from the tribal member who runs the Jamestown's operation, his perspective at least is that the future of shellfish absolutely necessitates aquaculture. There is no other path forward. And the value of these flupsies at John Wayne, they've got an operation that I'm imagining is not unlike Coast's operation in Kona on the Big Island of Hawaii that the tribe owns, for taking their oysters from the larval stage to the point where they've attached to something and are now heavier than water and sink. And then they can feed them and they grow before they get planted on beaches. In addition to oysters, they do some clams and geoducks. So that's interesting. And if anybody's interested in seeing the tribal flupsy, I would be happy to make those arrangements and go along for that as well.
Yeah, I'd be interested in both of those, actually.
Okay. Seeing heads nodding, so I'll work on that. Also along the lines of touring, I met with the director of the Jefferson County Historical Society, and we did a walking tour of Point Hudson. What day is it? Must have been Monday. Yeah, so I'm going backwards in the week, Monday. And I think had a really great conversation about the work that they have, how their work can feed into what Artifacts is doing for us, and ultimately how the Artifacts work can support some of their efforts to document and tell the story in the community. Shelley shared with me a copy of the Port Townsend Historic Architecture Walking Tour Guide. Looks like this. As well as the dream that they have of creating one of these that's specific to Point Hudson. And so I told her we would work with the Historical Society on that to get one of these produced for Point Hudson to tell that area's story, beginning with tribal uses from time immemorial to, the buildings of the 30s and the people who've occupied them through the years, including some of the vessels that live in our marina that are National Register vessels. So I think it will be really exciting, and I'm particularly interested in having these walking tours, which you buy, this little booklet I think is $6.50, so we could have these available at our registration office for our marina and RV tenants when they show up, and it will give them an opportunity to interact with this place much differently than they do now, with knowledge of its history and use. So I'm very excited about that. We also had some conversations about other kind of interpretive opportunities to document that tour experience, whether that could be kind of informational kiosks, or maybe they'd have a walking tour that has a phone app and you where you can follow along on the phone, something like that. Also along the lines of Point Hudson, Eric's not at the meeting today because we've got him like shackled to his desk working on the grant application for the Point Hudson Jetty project. He and Lisa are kind of in the full tilt to get all the material in. Our objective is to get that grant submitted early next week. And so good luck on that for us. It's been quite a process. It's a technically challenging grant, a whole lot of materials required to apply. But I guess I would still describe it as a long shot, but I am, you know, excited that we're getting to this point of making the ask, and all of this work, I believe, will be useful for us in the future. Artifacts, on that note, began their work today. So they were in Port Townsend doing exterior documentation and photography of Point Hudson. I met with, also on the Point Hudson theme, I met with Seamarine last week to kind of continue conversations about their tenancy and possible expansion of their tenancy, and really how to talk about a path forward for the conversation. Similarly, in taking the tour of the FLUPSI with the Jamestown Sklallam yesterday, you know, they have been in conversations with the port for a number of years about locating a FLUPSI at Point Hudson. And we are, you know, continuing that discussion about, you know, where one of these could actually go, how it could fit into the marina, culture and kind of ecosystem. I think their vision is that this would be a great way to tell the tribe's story of its engagement, both at Point Hudson, but more, you know, currently with aquaculture and the work that they do in that area. So a lot of Point Hudson activity, I guess, is what I'm trying to say with that. Also met with our moorage tenants last week for our monthly meeting. Had a conversation about a kind of a wide variety of topics, one of which includes the pump out facility, and just wondering how we can ensure its availability for tenants kind of more conveniently. Apparently we like to moor vessels right in front of it when that space is needed on the linear float. And so looking into that, trying to understand why it's there and if there's a better spot for it, if we really need two at the marina and all of that. So that's it from me. Any questions I can answer for the commissioners?
Have you let the Historic Society look at our engineer's blueprint from 1929?
Oh, I've not seen that myself. So
it's in the conference room.
Oh, I will go down and take a look at it. I guess I've looked at it, but I haven't paid close attention.
Shows Point Hudson as the Port Townsend Airport.
Huh.
I think that was in the days of the flying boat, but I don't think that ever happened.
No, I'll take a look at that and be happy to share that with them. Now, I think that the work that they're doing and the work they did, the whole community did, you know, led by the tribes with the Chechmahan Trail, and that interaction with Point Hudson is also, you know, really exciting to be able to tell that story and for the port to be part of that. It just seems like there's a whole lot of pieces coming together that could create some real magic at Point Hudson today.
Abigail?
Let's see. Well, I've been working really hard on the GAP cash transition, working with the consultant, Tara, who reviewed our accounting, chart of accounts, made some recommendations. So it requires a lot of, focus and not having being interrupted. So coming in on the weekends is really the best thing for me these days. And then Gene's working on the January numbers because, as you know, those were recorded as GAAP basis. So they're charged instead of as paid. And that's pretty arduous, too. But she's almost through with that. And I'm hoping that the June report will be, up to date with those January numbers. Also gearing up for the 2021 budget process. I just sent a draft budget schedule to Aaron to do a first review. We'll present that at your next meeting. Been working with the FAA to get our second grant billing approved on the construction, and actually it was just approved today, and I had submitted it about a month ago, so that's why we have that line of credit in place, thank goodness. And as far as that goes, we did our first draw on the line of credit for $400,000 yesterday, and that was to anticipate paying in the next few days the contractor close to $1.6 million. And then we anticipate another invoice from them within another couple weeks, and it'll probably be for the same amount. So I was trying to draw as little as possible but not leave us too thin in that area. So that's the highlights, I guess.
When Gene gets the gap changed over to cash for January, does that mean all of 2020 will be cash then?
Yes.
Nice. Cool. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Do we have any inkling of when the FAA is going to reimburse us?
That's what I was saying on the second grant billing, which was for $250,000. I had sent that in about a month ago, and they are really understaffed, and she wasn't able to get to it, and we were kind of playing phone tag too, but we did talk yesterday, and we got everything squared away. I got it uploaded to their website, and she approved it today. So we'll be getting that money, you know, within the next week.
Okay.
Which will be helpful.
Yeah. So I assume that the FAA is going to decline to reimburse us for any interest expense.
Right. That would be correct. But, I mean, getting this first reimbursement, that'll help with the next draw when we have to pay the next large invoice to the contractor. So, yeah, and we'll see what June numbers bring in with revenues too. So I should know that within another week or so. So I think it's coming along pretty well. As long as we don't get a big surge, we're lumped along pretty well.
Any other questions? Les, anything on your world? You're muted there, Les.
Yes, just one thing: that the legislature did extend out the Open Public Meetings Act's proclamation to 1 August at 11:59 p.m. So waiting for the governor's proclamation. It's supposed to come out today, but the legislature approved that yesterday. That's all I have, sir.
All right. Thanks, Les. Karen, anything on your docket? No? Okay. Commissioners.
Pam?
I hope you didn't hear the KPTZ interview a couple of weeks ago. I feel like it was, I had a deer in headlights moment on trying to describe Point Hudson. Too much information, trying to get down to 2 minutes. Our next scheduled interview is July 28th on Tuesday. And we're going to go about it a different way, and that is we're going to pre-record it so that it can be edited. So I'll be really happy about that, and I would like to request that I get to do mine over again on July 28th, and that you guys can pop in for any of the subsequent updates.
Yeah, I'll probably have to edit it, so...
Lots of work there. So we just Aaron described the airport update. I described the Point Hudson update. I think our next talk will be more focused on what is happening in the yard on the grounds.
So is there I completely missed this. So is this one of the regularly scheduled programs, or is this something that we're starting up? I had always invited back in the bad old days Larry Crockett and Jim Pivarnik to actually you know, do a port program like once a month. And they never took us up on that. So is it just you and Aaron talking about port things, or is it an interview with some KPTZ interviewer? What's the format?
Well, Chris Bricker approached me and said we could have a once a month slot, whatever time frame actually that we wanted. So I thought starting out on a monthly basis, especially since there's so much happening at the port, it could even be more often. That would be a good way to start. And Aaron speaks so well, I wanted to make sure that he was always giving some kind of update on there.
We've done one, is that right?
Yes.
Right.
Yes, and so we're just kind of forming it right now, going back and forth. But Chris threw out that anytime we want to do one within the next month, so I scheduled July 28th, since it's been, our last one was June 30th.
Okay. Anything else?
No. Your
commissioner comments? Bill?
Okay, so I had a little discussion with, pardon me, in preparation for a JBAT meeting last week. Pardon me. In preparation for a JBAT meeting last week, I had a little discussion with Mike Chapman and Steve Theringer about kind of the state of legislation to do with broadband. And one of the things that all of the focus seems to be on how to make it possible for private equity companies to serve broadband to rural customers. And my observation has kind of been with limited exceptions, private equity doesn't want to serve broadband to rural customers. So if that's the premise upon which you're basing all your help to get broadband out, it's just falling on deaf ears everywhere. There is some motion to change some of that legislation so that, you know, if there's not an incumbent provider that some more latitude will be given to the government agencies, in this case the port and the PUD, to establish some of these sorts of facilities. There is some state money out there on the order of in two separate pots. I think something approximating $50 million. There's federal money out there, but we're really largely excluded from taking advantage of that. So I'm hoping that some of the work that Mike and Steve and some of their colleagues in the legislature are doing, that this COVID crisis we're in has brought some focus, and we'll kind of move that ball forward. And that's about all I have.
No, Bill, I'll add to that. That's a great comment. And even in our county, we have witnessed the failure of private firms to bring broadband here. And even, not even the failure, but being handicapped by the private firm, or held hostage by the private firm, because there's no way they're going to make money at it, so they're not going to provide it. And it would seem, you know, like Aaron, for your director's meeting coming up with the ports, you know, that would also be good to talk about. That, gosh, those are nice pots of money that we could be doing some broadband if we could get the rules changed, like Bill's talking about.
Well, in Skagit County's experience, you know, the Port of Skagit and the Skagit PUD took the lead and created a governmental LLC. And the biggest difference that I think we noticed in Skagit is that those private companies expect to have their investment returned to them within just a couple of years, whereas the port and PUD were willing to look at really a life cycle of the fiber infrastructure. You know, they could look beyond a decade, you know, even 15 years.
Right.
And you can make money if you look further out, but you can't make money in the rural environment where you're connecting so few people per mile if you expect to get all your money back in 3 years.
Yeah. And that's the situation, is that all the money that's come so far has been really money to establish these networks. Well, you look at CenturyLink has an established network. What they just frankly don't want to operate them. So unless there's, you know, somebody decides that there's this infinite pool of money out there and they're just going to underwrite these services, they're just not going to find any takers. Skagit and several other of the port districts and PUDs that have been successful in their broadband enterprises have done it largely between between business parks. So they've built a port to business park to other business park kind of facility, and we're not blessed with large business parks dotted all over the landscape, and it's not really the need I think that we're trying to address here. So works for them doesn't work so well for us.
Yeah, well, in Skagit, you know, that backbone goes from Anacortes all the way to Concrete, so it gets pretty darn rural as you move east of Cedar Woolley.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the, you know, strategic partners there was Skagit County Government, came to Skagit Net with I think, my memory is, about $3 million in committed, we call them nine-tenths dollars there. I think that's the PIF equivalent here. So, you know, the combination of fiber for water telemetry that the PUD would install anyway or would stretch to make happen, plus this PIF money to install fiber where it doesn't make economic sense necessarily, all operated under this umbrella, really worked. And I think I understood last legislative session, wasn't it the Kitsap PUD that got unique authority to provide retail service?
Yeah, they don't say Kitsap. What they say is a
west of a
county of a certain size that's on the Puget Sound. That, I mean, they describe Kitsap in a very exclusive way, but don't say Kitsap.
Yeah, well, it has to apply to all similarly situated counties that start with a K and end with a P and have Itsap in the middle.
Right.
But I guess my point is that, you know, the door has opened a little bit, and if part of our problem here is the retail-facing piece of this, you know, maybe we should be having a more serious conversation about how to deliver the network, because it sure seems to me that our PUD is happily engaged in developing network resources. So the question for them is who delivers them.
Maybe we could get designated as the county with the heart of the Olympic, as a county with the heart of the Olympics in it.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. The Kitsap County has started, there's a lot of these local utility districts started up, and essentially they're parts of the community that can afford to do it on their own that have just set these things up. But it leaves everybody else out in the cold. So, you know, I'm not too enthusiastic about that kind of approach. We have a few of those communities and, you know, Wave really has already, addressed broadband for those, communities largely, where you find those little enclaves like Cala Point and the city and there's a couple of others around. But once you get outside that and you get to be more rural, then you have the problem, and it's not one that's being solved, but we're working on it.
Yeah. Okay. My only comment is, really nice to have the airport opened up, and it was great to see last week, our FBO, Scott Erickson, was very busy with annuals on aircraft that had been kind of stalled out. And so he was busy, and the museum had kids flying, taking on and off from the runway. So that was all great. Fun to be the first to land on a new runway. That's kind of a designation you don't get to do very often. And so with that, we'll move on to our next meeting. Will be on Wednesday, July 22nd at 5:30 via Zoom again. And with that, we are going to adjourn this meeting. Thank you.